I work in an environment at the University of Western Australia where I am constantly presented the opportunity, at least in my own mind and sometimes with other people, to reflect on the rationality of faith. So at UWA, for example, we have a very prominent atheist and agnostic society who's regularly advertising their stuff. But it seems to me there are forces in the world in general now which are perhaps inviting us to revisit the question of apologetics, so the rationality of faith. Again, it was very popular a few years ago and it kind of went out of popularity, and now I think we're being invited to revisit it, particularly since 11th of September 2001. There's a lot of interest in the world in religion, and therefore there's a lot of interest in the evils of religion, and there's a rise of a whole series of new authors in the public media who we call the new atheists. So one of the most prominent of whom is Richard Dawkins, who some of us may have seen in conversation or more like debate with George Pell on the ABC Q&A program last week, with the phenomenon of everyone in the audience clapping their little positions. And atheists would put their argument and they'd want to clap, and then George Pell would have put his, and then the Christians in the audience would clap. It was bogged down, really. So there's a couple of big ways of approaching apologetics. There's the Protestant way, which is primarily grounded in the Bible. So, and the underlying philosophical assumption of the Protestant apologetic approach is that reason is fallible. So steer clear of reason, go straight into the Bible, and if the Bible occasionally is unreasonable, that's okay, because our human reason is fallible. Then there's the more probably what might be described as the Catholic approach to apologetics, which is grounded in philosophy, and that's grounded in a fundamental assumption that God gives us reason, and reason is reasonable, and therefore we ought to read the Bible through the lens of reason. So both approaches have value, but today I want to start with a more Catholic or philosophical approach, because it's reason that the materialist will want to use to engage with us, rather than silly mythological and dreamt up stories, which Christians might call revelation. So my intention today is to offer a few thoughts which stem from philosophy, and then I'll conclude that this doesn't necessarily take us all the way, but it is a useful thing to do. It certainly doesn't take us automatically to Christian faith, but what it might do is to take us to a position where we think Christian faith is or has the capacity to be reasonable. So at least it can, if we take a philosophical approach, provide a basis for intelligent conversations with people who describe themselves as atheists, or the word I'm going to use today is materialists, because atheists don't like being defined against something else. So they like to stand for something, like anyone would. So let's acknowledge the atheist, of which there might be some here today, I hope so, and we'll use the frame materialists. So let's start with some definitions. Materialists generally subscribe to a philosophical view that the material universe is and ever has been the only reality, or the core reality, and that non-material realities like thoughts and dreams are entirely the product of material things like brains. In this view, consciousness cannot exist without a body or a brain. So things like love or beauty or truth are creations of processes of evolutionary biology. Okay, so materialist basic idea, brains create thoughts. Yes? Going to be hitting some heavy stuff today. Wake up, come on, stay with it. Philosophical theism, I'm going to say, is a basic school of thought which says that mind or spirit is the ultimately irreducible basis of reality. So I'm not going to take the definition from the dictionary that says theism is about belief in one God. I'm going to take a different angle, which is theism is actually a position that says that mind or spirit is the ultimately irreducible basis of all reality, and that it's mind or spirit which give rise to matter, energy, space and time. Okay, so just to recap, materialism, Thoughts and immaterial things like thoughts are the product of brains. Theism says that no, material things are the product of thoughts or immaterial realities. Okay, so this is the important distinction. Materialists, matter gives rise to spirit, including silly ideas like God. Theism, spirit gives rise to matter. So this is just a fundamental distinction to help us to get our head around the terms of reference of this conversation today. So, the materialist position is, on the face of it, compelling. In fact, it seems to be a no-brainer. But with our rational minds, it seems very hard for us to imagine how a disembodied consciousness, we'll say God for the moment, could exist outside space and time and matter and give rise to space and time and matter. How can theism stand up to what appears to be a logical no-brainer? Well, I'll offer a few thoughts which might help us to appreciate the inherent logic of theism and lead us to the conclusion that theism is more sensible and more rational than materialism. That's my thesis today. Okay, theism's more rational than atheism. If you're an atheist or a materialist, I'm trying to convince you today that it's more sensible to be a theist. Right, four arguments. These are the four that I'm going to run through. The first one is the longest, the last three are a little bit shorter. So the first one is a bit dry and dusty. If you get lost, don't worry, we'll come back to it. So first of all, theism helps us to answer the question, where do we come from, or why is there anything at all? So why is there anything at all? Now Dawkins' position on Q&A last week is quite clear on this. This would be common of materialists. To ask why does the universe exist is a nonsense question. Full stop. The universe simply is. End of story. It's a silly question. It's like saying, why do we call green green? Well, we do. Okay? End of story. Well, this is curious from a scientist because science is generally interested in what causes things to occur. Science seeks explanation for things, as does philosophy. So an apple falls on Newton's head, boing, and he says, well, that's interesting. What caused that to happen? Why did that happen? One of the reasons that materialists and theists get into this kind of thing with each other is that they're sometimes talking at cross purposes about what it means to explain the cause of something. In philosophy, there are two types of explanation for things. Scientific explanation and personal explanation. Scientific explanation, personal explanation. So the next bit of this talk is going to be focusing on the difference between scientific explanation and personal explanation. So one explanation of the universe, which is the one that scientists use, and it's perfectly valid, of course, is scientific explanation, based on the physical laws of cause and effect, the evolution of species, right back to the notion of the Big Bang. Science seeks to describe causation based on hard data, observable facts, and it tries to create logical arguments of sequence. But even scientists will admit that there are limits to science. Once we move back to even more fundamental questions about the origins of matter and space and time, science has nothing to say. Because at that level, there's nothing to observe. Or as Richard Dawkins says, we're asking questions which are silly questions and therefore ought not to be asked. So that's one kind of explanation, scientific explanation, logical cause and effect based on what we can observe, creating theories, testing them, seeing whether we can disprove them and so forth. However, there's a different kind of explanation, and it's about how the universe comes to being, and it's what could be called personal explanation. Well, not just how the universe comes into being, but how anything comes into being. Personal explanation, and that's based on the notion of desire or intention. A personal explanation for the causation of the universe is that God caused the universe to exist by a free choice to do so. God chooses the universe to exist. It's not about science, that's about intentionality. So it's a different kind of causation. Now, as soon as we start talking about divine desire and intention, materialists will rebel against the idea of an invisible, an invisible and scientifically non-provable existence having the characteristic of desire or intention. What are you talking about? Like, if you don't exist, how can you create or bring some, have an intention? If you're invisible and don't exist, how can that, all right, have intention? Going back to first principles, if you're a materialist, matter brings everything else into existence. So if you don't have fundamental existence, how can you have intention? Right. So what we would have to do is we'd have to say, is it reasonable to believe that non-physical realities could have intention? Are you with me? We would have to think about how a non-material reality could have an intention. Could that be conceivable? Well, I think it's possible in our own experience to intuit non-physical entities in everyday life. Here's a simple explanation of the difference between a scientific and a personal explanation. If I were to create a painting, and you wouldn't want to see what I create, the artistic genes that these girls have didn't come from me. If I was to create a painting, then one explanation of the cause of the painting could be made in terms of the physical forces of my hands moving the brush on the canvas. Yes? Caused the painting to occur, and it would be scientifically observable. However, there's a non-physical cause or explanation as well, which relates to my intention to paint this particular picture rather than any other picture. So I moved the paintbrush in this particular way because I thought it was a good idea to do so. So I painted a tree rather than a horse. There are a whole range of other potential outcomes, but I weighed up the options and I choose this one. A non-material reality, my thought, caused the paintbrush to move on the paper using the physical properties of my body and brought the painting into existence. Right, so that's personal explanation. In fact, the painting came about through a combination of scientific explanation and personal explanation. I chose this picture rather than this picture. Here's another simple example. Did you know that I can create sound using my mind? Are you thinking, how can I do this? You figured it out? I speak. Yes. Okay, so, or this. I created that with my mind. A non-material reality created that sound. Because I chose to do it. Musicians do it all the time, which just goes to prove that magicians are like gods. Music is one of the things that converted me, actually. So, theists argue that theism is rational because it provides a greater level of explanatory power in relation to the complexity of life that we experience than does materialism, because it adds personal explanation to scientific explanation, and it assents to both. Theism addresses the question, why is there anything at all more adequately than materialism? In fact, materialism really isn't interested in the first question, why is there anything at all? It's a nonsensical question. But to borrow a question which was coined by a great mathematician, Stephen Hawking, this is a quote of his, what is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Where did these mathematical equations and physical constants which underpin all of life come from? Why do they seem so elegantly adjusted to the creation of a universe which could evolve and support complex conscious life? The great philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas, who followed Aristotle's philosophy, spoke of something called efficient cause. An efficient cause is that which brings a potential into actual existence. It brings an idea into actual existence. God is the efficient cause, and by definition, and this is the important point of this whole section, by definition, is outside space and time. God is not an object accessible to scientific observation. This drives Richard Dawkins crazy. He hates this argument because he thinks it's a non-argument. But it works in the realm of logic. It doesn't work in the realm of science. God, by very definition, lies outside space and time. The existence of God provides a more comprehensive level of explanation than just scientific explanation, because it introduces personal causation or personal explanation as well as scientific explanation. It answers the question more adequately, why is there anything at all? The existence of God, by definition, the logical and irreducible first cause, adds to the probability that complex life would in fact emerge. Why? Because the universe was chosen to exist. Because the universe was chosen to exist, there exists within the universe a purposeful drive towards the evolution of life. As one of the great English philosophers of this century said, Keith Ward, he says, the hypothesis of God is fruitful not in experimental science but in philosophical thinking. Right? This is an important idea when it comes to conversations with materialists. The hypothesis of God is fruitful not in experimental science, because clearly God cannot be proved because God is outside space and time, but the idea of God is fruitful in philosophical thinking. It considerably raises the probability to the point of virtual certainty that the laws of nature should be as conducive to the emergence of life as they are. Why? Because they were chosen into existence to create life. So that's the first argument. The reasonableness of theism in the existence of anything at all, and in particular, the kind of universe which can generate life. Because equally, we may not have had anything at all. So that's the basic point. All right, second point. And this is to move us from philosophical logic about the origin of things to human experience. So the next three points that I want to make relate not to philosophical logic, thank God everybody's saying, but to try to bring us back to human experience. Generally speaking, let me ask this question. What is more important to us in everyday life? Is it the material stuff of a supposed reality, or is it the non-material reality of thoughts and concepts and values and meaning and beauty? For example, now Rani was going to be my little audiovisual aid here today, but the complex biochemistry of her body has her laid out in bed feeling sick. So I want you to imagine for a moment that Rani is here sitting here, and I was going to walk over to Rani and say, what is this? So that's the question I'd like to invite us to think about. Rani sitting there, what is that? Hmm? Oh, a person, okay. What's a person?
Living, breathing,
creation. Currently dying. Okay, so it's a constellation of atoms living, breathing, and currently suffering. Okay, anything else? Sorry? Oh, someone have a relationship with, okay. I have a relationship with my dog, okay. Yep, good.
A particular arrangement of atoms and molecules.
Okay, anything else? What is this Rani thing here?
Someone has the ability to create.
Ah, yes. somebody who has the ability to create. So my constellation of molecules got together with Rani's constellation of molecules, and we created two other little constellations of molecules who are sitting over there. That's pretty cool. So we're...
Yeah, but
I'll
treat you like music
and stuff. Oh, music. Somebody who can create music. Now my heart's moving. Sorry?
Most evolved constellation.
Oh, and a super evolved constellation. Okay. Yeah. Richard Dawkins would love you. We are a super evolved constellation of molecules. Rani, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall love thee better after death. What is more important and fundamental, the spiritual reality or the material reality in our human experience? What created that poem? Was it the brain? Or was the brain used by something else? Did the brain give rise to that poem? Or did something use the brain to give rise to that poem? Something non-material. My heart and spirit. I'm assuming you're speaking metaphorically here. Thirdly, I don't know the answer to the question, by the way. I'm just arguing as a theist. It's quite clearly the spirit. The essentially unobservable mystery of consciousness is my third point. Would you agree that consciousness is a non-material reality? Would you agree that consciousness is a non-material reality? Can you put consciousness under a microscope? Who is it, or what is it, that looks down a microscope or looks through a telescope? Who is it in you that is listening to me? Can you observe it? Who is it who is observing me talking at you? Can you observe it?
No.
What are you observing?
You can observe the nerve ending activated.
So who is the observer of the nerve endings being activated? Trying to play with our heads here. Come on. Sorry? Need to speak up, James. Can't hear you. Oh, I can't. Sorry, I can't hear you. Yell. Yeah.
If they can see, like, what's happening, and also record observations using a function of intelligence, and then follow that through, so you can observe this person as part of the conscious realm because of their own complex coming from the same set of consciousness that relates fundamentality of existence towards that person.
So we can observe others?
We can observe others in turn ourselves by the same stream of consciousness that we're experiencing.
Okay. See. Thank you. So you think you can observe yourself? Okay.
I think we experience the observation of ourselves because of the speed of the loop within the brain. Because it's like the deja vu experience. That you think you've seen something before, because by the time you see it, you also store the experience of having seen it, and therefore you think you're repeating that experience. So it's very tough. The loop is going on all the time, and I think this can give the sensation of being an external observer of yourself.
Okay. So the experience of being an observer of ourselves could be an illusion.
No, it's real.
Oh, it's real.
It's real.
Okay. Okay. But can you observe it? Yes. If you're observing yourself, are you observing yourself? Okay.
In the observation, you change the observer. I mean, if the observer is observing himself, then you change yourself in the process.
So the observer changes what it observes. So
if you think you're. Yes,
yeah. So the observer is part of the experiment. Okay.
Well, here's a thought.
Yep.
We can map consciousness,
yep.
With all our clever equipment. Right? I mean, eventually we'll be able to get down to the quantum level. We'll be able to see those electrons. But
if we're observing.
According to quantum physics, yep. Though. We won't be able to predict it.
Yes.
We will not be able to predict what the consciousness will do. So you can map everything that's gone from water that moment, but you can't predict what that consciousness is going to do next.
So
it has a kind of
autonomy.
Yeah.
Okay. And the question is, if we're mapping our consciousness using scientific instruments, are we observing our consciousness, or what is observing the mapping of ourselves on the instrument? All right, so that's just to take home to think about when you're feeling like you can't go to sleep at midnight.
Well, I'm aware I can observe myself doing things, I'm not sure I can actually observe myself.
Yes, so you can observe yourself speaking to me, but can you observe the one who's observing you speaking to me? Yeah, what is the self?
Yes.
Yes.
So what you're creating is a non-I.
So I can observe me, but can I observe I?
You're saying, of course you can't observe something that is unobservable.
Yeah. Okay. So therefore, do you exist? If you can't.
If you agree that your life is a material thing, then yes, you can prove that you exist. So you're not disproving the materialists, you're just offering a completely different explanation that doesn't fit into their framework at all.
But everything has to fit into their framework.
Okay. You could be right. Can we pick that up over morning tea? Because my head's blowing. I think there's something in the inherently, I think the inherently unobservable nature of consciousness that suggests an argument. If we can't observe it, does it exist? Well, yes. We have a sense in which we exist, but can we observe ourselves? I think we can't. But that's a good talking point to have with a materialist anyway. So the next time you're having a conversation with a materialist, that gives you an interesting line of inquiry. If they can't observe themselves, then it's worth asking, by their own logic, do they exist? All right. I'm just going to leave that one for the moment. It's something to mull over. Fourthly, the autonomy of dreams. Now, I find dreams a fascinating experience. Dreams do correlate with electrical activity in the brain, no doubt about that. They're observable in a sleep lab. So I had one of the parents at my daughter's school is a sleep scientist. So if people are having sleep disturbance, he takes them into the lab, wires them up and tries to get them to sleep, and on a huge bank of monitors sees what's happening in their brains. So he knows they're dreaming because the particular wave patterns of the brain do their thing. And when the person wakes up, they say, "I've just had a dream." Right, so he can correlate human experience of the dream, which is unobservable, with the scientific instruments, which are observable, and correlate those two things together and say, when this person reports they're dreaming, this is what's happening in their brain. Okay. So that's a fair, that's a correlation. It actually says nothing about cause, but it does say something about correlation. The interesting thing he says is, and it completely blows his mind as a sleep scientist, and he still can't get his head around this, is that he knows from the instrumentation that the person's been dreaming within a sleep cycle from going to sleep to waking up, they've dreamt for 3 minutes. But the person will wake up and do what Rani does occasionally and recite a dream which has been like a book.
Yeah.
It's a saga which has gone on for weeks. But he knows that they've only been dreaming for 3 minutes. Now, he says, that's a curious phenomenon for me as a scientist. He says, but what is clear is that the saga of Rani's dream cannot be put on the sleep monitor. Like, it can't go click and we can sit down and watch a good movie of Rani's dream. That doesn't happen. All we've got is a few blips on the screen. The dream is an entirely subjective experience. Now, I could say to you, I had a dream last night, in fact, multiple dreams. And I would say to you, is that a reasonable thing for you to believe? You'd say, yeah, okay. Yeah, I believe that. I believe you had a dream last night. Can I prove it? No. Can't prove it. That's an entirely subjective experience. And I think to some extent the experience of God is entirely subjective as well on one level, and yet we speak about it as if it really exists. Does it really exist? Don't know. Is it reasonable to exist? Is it reasonable to speculate that it's possible or logical or coherent? Yes, it's reasonable. And that's all I'm trying to do today, is to suggest that non-material realities have a fundamental level of existence which lies underneath physical reality. The question here would be, does the brain biochemistry cause the dream experience, or does the dream cause the brain activity? If you're a materialist, you say, no, consciousness can't exist outside brains, it's the brain that causes the dream. If you're a theist, you may well say, and I propose that this is a reasonable and logical argument, that the dream is creating the brain activity, that the dream underlies the brain. Is that a reasonable possibility to consider? Well, I think it's reasonable. Is it provable? No, because that's a philosophical position. But I'm not trying to prove it. All I'm trying to invite us to consider is whether it's reasonable. So what can we conclude at 5 to 11? One, it's reasonable to argue that the universe begins in a logical and irreducible first cause which lies outside space and time. Why? Because that's more rational and has more explanatory power than the materialist position that it has simply always existed. Because the theistic position argues more coherently and more reasonably why anything exists at all. So it adds personal explanation to scientific explanation and is willing to assent to both. Secondly, it is reasonable on the basis of human experience and for all practical purposes that non-material realities like thoughts and dreams and values and poetry and music and relationships are generally more important in our lives than pure physical realities which are describable by physics and chemistry. Thirdly, it is reasonable to believe that non-material consciousness gives rise to physical brain activity rather than the other way around, even though it's unprovable, because it's a philosophical position rather than a scientific statement. It is reasonable to believe, from observing the non-material reality of our own consciousness, the likelihood of a non-material divine consciousness, God, who dreams a universe into being, loaded with autonomous and rather strange and lovable characters called human beings. Just like your dreams are populated by strange, lovable and sometimes scary autonomous characters, could it be that a divine consciousness dreams a universe into being, populated by the same sorts of strange, lovable and sometimes very scary characters? Furthermore, God might even show up in his own dream as a character called Christ. But that would be a completely different story.